May it please the court, I'm Andrew Cooper, 23036. The dismissal order in this case should be reversed because the defendant's speedy trial right was honored. I want to begin by alerting the court to a portion of the record that neither of the parties highlighted, and that's the transcript of the June 17th, 2008 hearing, pages 20 through 29. To put that in context, the prosecution has appealed the July 21st, 2008 ruling that the exceptions contained in subsection 6 do not apply to calculations of time under subsection 2. The defense has asked that the court affirm the order of dismissal on an alternative ground, the trial court's granting of a continuance on March 31st of 2008. Now, to perfect their opposition to that motion to continue, the defense had to file and did file on April 30th, 2008, a motion to dismiss based on speedy trial, their first motion to dismiss. The June 17th, 2008 transcript is significant because on that date, the defense provided additional information that they had heard from the family about the victim and their interactions within the family. And the prosecution argued that that information, if anything, further supported the granting of the motion to continue. And the district court agreed, saying that I am more convinced than before. So our position is that although the March 31st record was sufficient to grant that continuance, further record is supplemented on June 17th.
And that transcript is in the record, it just wasn't cited in the briefs. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Okay. Let me ask you, as long as we're talking about events of June, on June 6th, the defendant also moved for a continuance, did he not? And it was denied? And I wanted to know what was the grounds for moving a continuance on the grounds for moving for a continuance on June 6th and what the defendant argued. And I don't have, I thought that's what you're going to talk about, but.
No, and okay. I don't know what those grounds were. I think it undermines any notion that the defense was truly trying to move the case along. And in fact, if the court looks at earlier points in the record from the first trial, there were numerous waivers of speedy trial by the defense. But statutorily, I don't think that that motion to continue in 2000, motion to continue the trial by the defense in 2008 is statutorily significant because it was denied. By statute, if the defense moves to continue the trial and it's granted, that's a waiver of speedy trial.
Ask you a broader question. The defendant's position, as I understand, is that every case that comes back for retrial after remand basically has to be tried within 6 months. What's the practice in Arapahoe County in terms of retrying remanded cases? Are they all retried within 6 months?
No. I would be surprised if there are any that are retried that quickly. Perhaps there are some, but that's certainly not the normal practice. Typically, the appeals of convictions take so long to resolve that by the time the case is remanded following a reversal, both sides need more time to prepare.
So how are they being continued? Under what basis are they being continued? Or what basis is the Speedy Trial Act not being violated in all those cases?
Well, in some instances, the defense will file a motion to continue, which operates under subsection 6 as a waiver.
So the courts infer that subsection 6 exclusions of time apply to cases after remand.
Well,
as a practical matter, is what you're saying.
I think that's correct. And I said subsection 6, and 6F does exclude from the speedy trial calculation delays at the instance of defendant. But actually, what I should have said is subsection 3, because under subsection 3, a waiver of speedy a motion to continue a set trial date operates as a waiver of speedy trial. So that is the normal practice in Arapahoe County, and I imagine in courts throughout the state. I referred in the reply brief to the American Bar Association standards, and one of the comments to those standards notes that typically after a conviction has been reversed on appeal, a lot of time has passed and both sides need time to become familiar with the issues, to track down witnesses. Another reason to have those exceptions apply.
So when the prosecution asks for a continuance after remand, is that typically granted because they can't find the witnesses? Is that the practice?
Well, I think it depends on the grounds that are stated by the prosecution.
By subsection 6 to determine whether those grounds justify exclusion of time?
That's correct, 6G. Hmm. That would be the most typical instance, the need to track down witnesses or other material evidence. I think there is one other subsection 6 exception that would apply, and that has to do with in felony cases, if the nature of the case is significantly serious, that's subsection 6G, Roman numeral 2. And that doesn't necessarily entail having to find witnesses or obtain evidence. It's instead 6G2 talks about exceptional circumstances because of the nature of the case.
So you're suggesting if we were to search some of the records in Arapahoe County, we would find orders incorporating the 6G or Section 6 exclusions to cases that are coming back for retrial after remand?
Well, I think that's right. And it may be that there's not explicit discussion about the issue of whether the exceptions under 6 apply to 2, because it's just assumed by the parties, I think, typically.
So what happened in this case?
Well, in this case, the defense raised the issue, and the district court judge bought it, I think, erroneously. But that's what happened in this case.
So oftentimes, when there's a question of ambiguity, the parties will give us some guidance from legislative history. Neither one has done that here. Am I to assume that there isn't anything out there that tells us why subsection 2 doesn't make a reference to subsection 6 or subsection 1? Or is there anything in the legislative history that helps us here, one way or the other?
Well, I have not dug into the specifics of the discussions by the legislature in hearings, but there is one thing in the legislative history that I think is significant. There's three cases that we've discussed in the briefs: Lovano, Sanchez, and Medina, which do say that the exceptions in subsection 6 apply to subsection 3. As far as legislative history is concerned, the speedy trial statute has been amended several times since those three decisions were issued, including amendments to subsection 6. And the legislature is presumed to know the court's interpretations of its statutes. And when the legislature revisits statutes and amends them in some way, but does not correct a purported misinterpretation by the courts, then that is a further indication that the courts got it right. So I think the fact that the statute and subsection 6 specifically has been amended several times since Lovano, Sanchez, and Medina were decided, that's a pretty strong indication that the legislature believes that the exceptions under 6 do apply to 3. And I would argue that it's an indication that the exceptions under 6 also apply to 2. Because if the legislature had thought, by golly, the courts got it wrong in Lovano, Sanchez, and Medina, we'd better fix this statute to make sure what we really meant, I think that they would have amended both 3 and 2. And they didn't do that. And I think that that's further indication that the exceptions under 6 apply to 2 just as the exceptions under 6 apply to 3. That's what I can say about the legislative history. I mentioned the June 17th transcript as it relates to the issue of the alternative grounds that the defense has argued. I don't think the court needs to address those alternative grounds. Typically, when it's noted that a lower court's ruling can be affirmed on grounds rejected by or not even considered by the lower court, typically that's alternative legal grounds to address the same ruling that's being challenged by the appellant. And I think it's a stretch of that principle to say that the lower court's ruling here should be affirmed because of something that happened not on in July of 2008, but a different ruling in March of 2008. And declining to address that alternative ground that the defense is seeking affirmance on doesn't mean that that issue would evade review, because if the court finds in the prosecution's favor here that the district court got it wrong, six does apply to two, and a new trial is granted and the defendant is convicted, I think the defendant could always, in a direct appeal of that conviction, raise that issue that they're trying to raise here concerning the March 31st continuance. So with that, if the court has no other questions.
I do have one, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I think in Lovano, I read quickly, Lovano, Medina, Sanchez all come up under subsection 3. But if I'm not mistaken, in each of those cases, it was the defendant who took an action that requested the continuance. So it seems like maybe all the court is saying is that once a trial date is fixed by the court, paren, even after remand, if the defendant requests a continuance, the time is excluded.
Well, what I can say in response to that is that Medina was under subsection 6B, which is for interlocutory appeals, and that exception says that it applies to either prosecution or defense interlocks. And Sanchez was under A, which has to do with addressing competency of the defendant, which isn't something that the defendant is necessarily doing of his own volition. Either side or the court could raise the issue of competency. The defense might not even be wanting competency to be questioned at all, but the court on its own could because of conduct in the courtroom, ask that competency proceedings begin.
Any reason why Powell doesn't control this case?
Well, I think it does. I think Powell decides the case. And Powell explicitly says that the exceptions in 6 apply to 2. And Jameson does also, although that's a 6F, so it is a delay at the instance of defendant. But I think Powell and together with Jameson should be determinative. And if no other questions, I ask to reserve my time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have a little over 2 minutes for any rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Karen Taylor, registration number 24810, and I represent Mr. Mosley in this appeal. I'm not entirely sure where to start. I think I want to make a couple of points, and I'm happy to take any questions that the court has about Mr. Mosley's position here. Judge Loeb, in terms of like looking to figure out how to read an ambiguity in the statute and what information there is out there about that, I would just say, you know, the statute existed in some form similar to what it exists now for many, many years. I think predating the tapes that the legislature has in terms of being able to go back and listen to the legislative hearings about what the statute means. So I think we're kind of stuck with the text of the statute. But it's Mr. Mosley's position that that's all the court needs.
Well, I understand that. But I knew that there was a threshold issue about whether it was ambiguous in the first place. That
exactly.
We have to address, and I recognize that there's a dispute about that, but it did strike me that if it is ambiguous, we got to look all kinds of places, and I was struck by the fact that neither side had given us any legislative history.
And I think that's not uncommon in some of these statutes that have been around for a very long time. And so looking at some of the other aspects of this, well, first I guess I'll explain just to make very clear Mr. Mosley's position, that there isn't an ambiguity here. Just because the district attorney doesn't like the result that the statute requires in this case doesn't mean the language is ambiguous. And the district attorney has provided, for example, the ABA standards. Mr. Mosley provided the citation to the federal speedy trial statute. And those are situations where the statutes make absolutely clear that all the exclusions and exceptions that those provisions contain apply to cases that have been reversed on appeal. And it's actually, it's almost like when you look at those in comparison with Colorado statute, it becomes even more clear that the plain language of 18-1405 does not, the exclusions in subsection 6 have not been written to apply to time frames under subsection 2.
So including the exclusion about a continuance at the behest of the defendant?
Yes, under the statute, yes, that's correct, Your Honor, on its face. And it's, and,
you know, there absolutely are no exclusions from section 2. The case must be tried within 6 months.
No, that's different. That's different. And I guess this is where it gets into the difference between what a statute requires and just sort of what the law about constitutional rights are. This statute effectuates a defendant's speedy trial rights. And just like any other constitutional right that a defendant has, the defendant can waive that right. So even if we didn't have 18-1405, if a conviction were reversed on appeal and the defendant fled the country because he didn't want to be there for the retrial, even if there wasn't 18-1405, could a court find that the defendant had waived his right to a speedy trial? Yes. The statute...
Based on what? The statute doesn't say anything about that.
The right pre-existed the statute. The right exists apart from the statute. Defendants can waive their constitutional rights. Speedy trial is one of the rights that actually someone else can waive for the defendant. The lawyer can waive the speedy trial right for a defendant over the defendant's own wishes. So it's clear that in the speedy trial context, actions of a defendant can waive that right, just like they can waive all constitutional rights, even if there wasn't a statute.
Colorado, the statutory speedy trial right and the constitutional speedy trial right are often and almost always analyzed separately, right? The constitutional right to speedy trial, we often analyze under harms and that sort of thing. The statutory speedy trial, we analyze for times, and that's really something different. The judge here didn't really address the constitutional speedy trial right. She addressed the statutory.
That's right.
And that's what we're being called on to interpret. So how can we say that there are no exclusions, no exceptions to Section 2 if the defendant himself can extend it? And there's no words in there that provide for that.
Well, there's two things. Subsection 6 is the subsection that contains the qualifying limitation language. So those limitation language, that limitation language doesn't exist in the other subsections. It exists specifically in subsection F. And so is there overlap between those two existing out in the world? Yes, because one of the subsections of subsection F is the catch-all if the defendant does something, which is, again, and the way that a defendant could waive that right even without the existence of a statute. What Judge Antrim did below was to look at the Zedek case and look at the Powell case and to try to find a consistent, coherent rule looking at those two cases. And the rule that she came up with, her ruling actually was that absent some action on the part of the defendant, this trial had to happen after remand within 6 months.
Nothing in Section 2 that says absent some action on the part of the defendant, right? And you're inferring that meant he could waive his constitutional right to speedy trial.
He can.
Which he can, of course.
But he can, yes.
The question is, can he waive his statutory right to speedy trial under Section 2?
That's what Judge Antrim believed that Powell said.
Why do you think Section 2 only applies to the defendant's rights? Why didn't the prosecution have some rights under Section 2?
Well, I think, without legislative history to guide me, I can think of policy reasons why that would be the case. First of all, If you look at the ABA standards that Mr. Cooper supplied this court, they say that just as court congestion should not ordinarily be a basis for allowing added delay, failure of the prosecutor to be prepared to go to trial should not ordinarily be recognized as grounds for extending the speedy trial time limitations. That's in the commentary to ABA standard 12.2.3D. And, you know, when a case has been reversed on appeal, there's already been a trial. So the parties have seen how the witnesses will testify and how the evidence is going to come out at trial. They know what the evidence looks like. The appeal has usually resolved any outstanding legal issues that there were in the case. Often this court will say, because this issue will arise on retrial, we'll go ahead and decide it. So, time-consuming pretrial issues that would exist pretrial are usually either non-existent or gone by the time the case comes back on appeal. And there's also the thought that the state needs to move this process along once it has unsuccessfully tried someone the first time. In this case, what the state is actually asking for is its third chance to try Mr. Mosley in this case. So there are policy reasons that one can think of why the legislature would want the time running more quickly after this court, after the higher court has decided to reverse a conviction on appeal.
There are also reasons why it might also need the exclusions. Witness availability can become a problem after retrial. Isn't that so? What if the defendant, as the prosecution suggests, what if the defendant becomes mentally incapable 5 months and 28 days after the remand? It's not his own doing, but the prosecution has to get, or the system has to deal with that.
Well, I think that's why the court, I think that's why Judge Antrim put the qualifying language on it that she did, absent some part of, absent some action on the part of the defendant, because it's still the defendant's right. And so if the defendant is taking some action that delays the case or is the cause of an action that delays the case, that's not going to count in the speedy trial calculation. That was her position. And Powell says we're going to reject. All that Powell said was if we read it literally, which in Powell, that was the argument. That is the argument that was made in Powell. It is literally on the face of the statute. There are no exceptions. We're not going to do that. So we won't adopt an absolute rule that that there are no exceptions at all. In terms of fleshing out what that means beyond that, Powell didn't do that.
Let's say on the 5 months and 28 days into the time, they start the new trial. And on 6 months and 5 days into the time, that trial is, there's a mistrial caused by a hung jury, no one's fault. That defendant walks under your interpretation? Did you follow my example?
I think that they have whatever time is left to retry him.
I just said, if it's after 6 months, 6 months and 5 days after the remand.
Well, presumably if the trial started on the very last, are you suggesting the trial started on the very last day of speedy?
On the day before.
Yeah, then they have 1 day. I mean, there was 1 day left in the period when the trial started. What it says is don't wait till the last minute, Your Honor. I mean, and that is exactly what happened here in the case of the witness as well. The prosecution knew the case was coming back. It had been reversed by this court. The state chose not to file a petition asking the Supreme Court to review the case. And then it waited many months to begin to try to locate the alleged victim in this case. What subsection two
says? That's the alternative issue, though, isn't it? That's a fact.
What subsection two says is don't do that. Don't do that. These cases are important. They've already been tried once. In this case, there was a confrontation clause violation. So the conviction that had been obtained against Mr. Mosley was in violation of the Constitution. And this statute simply says get back there and retry this case as soon as possible. Give priority to these cases that have already been tried once and have been reversed on appeal. That's a legitimate choice, and it makes sense. These cases are not in the same posture as a case that's never been tried before. For those reasons that I was saying earlier, Judge Richman, it's a different case.
Now, Mr. Mosley never argued this position within the six-month period, though, did he? When he argued against the continuance in March, he never mentioned Section 2.
I believe the first motion was focused on subsection 1.
And subsection 6.
And subsection.
And the second argument, we sort of sought reconsideration, it was focused on subsection 6.
I think the second motion argued all of it.
So he even took the position, or his counsel even took the position, that's the Section 6 exclusions must be considered.
Well, she was strenuously objecting to the fact that there was even due diligence to continue it in the first place. That's correct. That's where her focus was when the issue first came up.
This very important right to be retried was never raised by the defendant until sometime in July.
Well, he had been asserting his right to a speedy trial the whole time, and his right to be be tried within 6 months.
Then I go back to the question I asked Mr. Cooper. Why did he ask for a continuance on June 7th, or 6th? Do you know anything about that?
You know, Your Honor, since no one had briefed that, I am not sure. I know that there was an issue with the prosecution not having yet another witness, and I don't know if it... I don't recall.
The record says it was defendant's motion.
I don't know more than that, the substance of that. And the other thing I wanted to... just briefly touching upon that notion of the first decision to continue this trial, it would seem to be a waste of judicial efficiency, a waste of judicial resources to only address the second motion and not the first motion, send it back for a trial, and then have another division of this court, assuming there was even a conviction, but having to to decide again this issue of the correctness of the court's first ruling. And I just wanted to spend a minute on that, because basically both the prosecutor below and the prosecution on appeal now are saying that the problem in timely getting the victim to trial was the fact that she now, they use the word now, as in 2008, now she goes by a different last name, not the last name she had at the time of the filing of the charges, and that's the same name as her grandfather. So it's sort of hinting at, we didn't send a fugitive apprehension team to her grandfather's house, and he wouldn't call us back when we did, and now we realize she's going by this other name, and we need the additional time. We think we found her under this other name. There is no now. The alleged victim was using the name that the prosecution eventually found her under at the first trial. And that's clear. If you look at the transcript of September 4th, 2003, during the first trial, that when the alleged victim is called to the stand, the transcript identifies her under that name that the prosecution claims they just now learned of. And if you look at page 32 of that same day of trial, September 4th, 2003, the judge called her by the name that the prosecution says we just now found out that she was using.
Let me ask you a question. If we do get to this alternative issue, do you agree that the standard of review on that issue is abuse of discretion?
That appears to be what the case law says, Your Honor. And that's why looking at the number of times that she was using the name that the prosecution claims they just found is so relevant. In addition to those mentions in the transcript of the first trial, her own letters to the district attorney's office used that name, and the victim compensation letters sent to the district attorney in 2003, so 5 years before the events leading to the continuance, used that same last name. And defense counsel below attached those letters as Exhibit C to the first written motion to dismiss that was filed in April of 2008. So to find that there's due diligence when the prosecution apparently spent the time it did spend on it looking for someone under the wrong name, when the record establishes beyond dispute that they had the correct information the entire time, that simply cannot constitute due diligence to grant a continuance over the defendant's objection. So, Your Honors, thank you for your time. We would ask that this court affirm the order of the district court.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Mr. Cooper, you've got a little over 2 minutes.
If the court does reach the alternative issue, then the standard of review is abuse of discretion. And I think under Scialaba, Kuhlbeck, and Wolf, the court's ruling was well within its discretion. And maybe the way to think about that is if there hadn't been a mistrial in the second trial and the defendant had instead been convicted and the defendant, we were here because the defendant was appealing that conviction, and the challenge was that March 31st continuance, I'd submit that the court would be deferring to that finding. There's lots of support in the record, support for the court's finding that there was due diligence. Regarding legislative history, I think indirectly we did refer to some legislative history because we noted that the Pipkin case and the Running Bear case both indicated that the legislative history shows that the ABA standards were the intent of the legislature in adopting this statute, and the ABA standards would allow for these exceptions to apply to subsection 2. Regarding the plain language argument, the courts have interpreted the 6 exceptions to apply to 3, and I see no logical reason why they would apply to 3 but not apply to 2, since the plain language of 3 does not incorporate them.
And suggest that the defendant can waive his constitutional right to speedy trial. These situations different under subsection 3 or the example she came up with.
Well, and again, that's not in the plain language of 3. And going back to the Sanchez case and the incompetency issue, although an indication that the defendant might be incompetent, I suppose, arises from the defendant. The defense isn't necessarily requesting that the competency be assessed. That could be done sua sponte by the court. I would ask that the order of dismissal be reversed.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments. Case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course.